Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm the corpse of Matt Gerandese. Why do I sound like myself, you ask? It's because I'm one of those smart zombies that you might have heard so much about. No worse for the wear. Still got the old noodle upstairs.
Coming to a TV in your home in Zack Snyder's Army of the Dead, which is the subject of today's podcast. I don't even know where to begin. So Zack Snyder's first feature film was a remake of the George A. Romero landmark Dawn of the Dead. And while some Puritans may find this position heretical, I happen to like that movie.
I like it too. I know for a fact that you hold it in higher regard than I do, but I do think it's among Snyder's better flicks for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I go back and forth, but it is arguably my favorite of his works. And I think most of the reason for that, in addition to just it's a fun, well-paced zombie movie, good doses of humor here or there, it also predates the point at which Zack Snyder began breathing nothing but his own farts.
Yeah, it doesn't have the ponderous slow motion that you get with everything from 300 onward.
Right. And so, yeah, I like it quite a bit, I think, for that reason. And perhaps if Army of the Dead was made as an immediate follow-up to Dawn of the Dead, maybe some of that lighthearted absence of self-seriousness may have defined this film as well. It also might have been like 45 minutes shorter. Probably wouldn't have hurt. And I might have liked it better. But just to let the cat out of the bag right now, I didn't like this movie a whole lot. Neither did Matt.
Yeah, I mean, it aspires to be a little bit more breezy than his recent output. I mean, it's
sometimes
it's breezier than Batman v Superman, but fucking so is The Killing Fields.
So is The Look of Silence.
Yeah, that movie is a dirge.
So, the movie's about a team of, I don't know, like some ex-soldiers and some just treasure hunters.
And some people who have expertise in a specific area, which is part and parcel of heist movies.
Yeah, how these things work. The team is led by Dave Bautista. They are tasked by wealthy, shady person Hiroyuki Sanada to pull $200 million out of the vault in the basement of his casino before Vegas, which is overrun with zombies and has been walled off for X number of years, is nuked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, blown off the face of creation, and they have 72 hours or thereabouts to get in and get out, and then they all split a massive payday.
Yeah, apparently he's going to give them a quarter of that, and they split it unevenly, incidentally. They're supposed to split it about seven ways, and well, that's a decent chunk of change if you can make it out alive, of course. Kind of like Peninsula, except that movie's better. So
I was reminded of Peninsula not seldom watching this movie quite frequently.
And not to Army of the Dead's benefit, no. I suspect.
We open with happy newlyweds speeding down a desert highway. Just got hitched. They've got tin cans trailing behind their car. And she starts giving him roadhead. And he's having a hard time staying in his lane. Meanwhile, a convoy of military Humvees and other vehicles are coming the opposite way, and the two guys leading the caravan are bantering about, you know, they have some mysterious cargo, even they don't know what it is. Oh, maybe it's Bigfoot, maybe it's this, maybe it's that,
maybe it's aliens, blah blah blah. You know where this is going, but the scene decides to take 2 minutes to get there anyway.
Yeah, we get a lot more soldier back and forth than I was expecting.
Yeah, Mr. Roadhead drifts into the oncoming lane and plows directly into the convoy, which causes the vehicle carrying the payload to blow up. The payload's in this big metal box, you know, goes flying into the road. Humvees swerve off, and lo and behold, the metal box, the fucking door has swung open on it, and guess what's inside? It's a smart super zombie.
Yeah, he looks like, well, you said Uruk-hai, which is very apt, and then a little bit of the aliens and Prometheus a little bit, too. He's like a big kind of Lurtz-looking motherfucker with kind of straggly, greasy hair, but the build of a hunky alien, I don't know.
Right. I mean, when I said Uruk-hai, it's mostly their behavior and level of intelligence.
Right.
And just the kind of noises they make. In terms of appearance, a little bit less so. I think Aliens and Prometheus is right, although they have more tactile-looking faces, less made out of, I don't know, silicone. But in any case, yeah, fucker gets loose and massacres what remains of the convoy, makes a couple of disciples.
Yeah,
or
he
makes
short work of the whole team, although not quite short enough. This is another scene that felt a little long in the tooth to me. You don't get to 2.5 hours by accident, or maybe you do. So then the daddy zombie and his new acolytes take in a vista of Las Vegas at night, and then we got a montage. Zack Snyder is just addicted to these montages now. He did one at the opening of Justice League, at least the cut that I saw. I'm sure it's in his version too.
Right.
The Everybody Knows, the Leonard Cohen cover. He did it, I think, most famously and successfully, for my money, opening credits of Watchmen.
Yeah.
It's like the only way he knows how to do opening credits anymore. It's like a slow-mo montage set to some melancholy track or tongue-in-cheek needle drop of some kind, as we're introduced to some of the key players.
Or if it goes on long enough, both.
Right.
Like, this started out as a tongue-in-cheek sort of play. Like, it opens with Richard Cheese,
yes,
right?
Yeah, speaking of Dawn of the Dead,
yeah,
04.
Yeah. Those of you not familiar with Richard Cheese, he's sort of a jokey,
cheesy lounge
parody
lizard.
Lounge singer,
yeah.
Act. And he did a lounge cover of Down with the Sickness for Dawn of the Dead, which is very funny.
I mean, that's funny just on paper. Here, the cover is of Viva Las Vegas, which is the kind of thing that an actual lounge singer would cover. And so
it's much diminished returns.
Yeah, the humor is kind of diluted there. And I was further incensed because when the newlyweds are speeding down the highway at night, going to town on each other, they're blasting Suspicious Minds, mm-hmm. Elvis Presley song. And I thought, okay, Zack Snyder is exercising uncharacteristic restraint and good taste by not blasting Viva Las Vegas. And little did I know he was saving it for not even 5 minutes later.
Yeah. And then it transitions at some point from Richard Cheese to some female vocalist, like, I don't know. I can't even remember which fucking song she sings. But again, it starts out like kind of vaguely sort of upbeat and then gets dirge-like as, you know, bad shit starts happening in the montage and it's the last stand and people are pulling behind the whatever.
Yeah, Dave Bautista sees someone get their neck chomped on right in front of him and then the wall is assembled. It's a bunch of shipping containers packed on top of one another.
And thwack. And that's basically it. So in the movie proper, Dave Bautista, who is now a fucking fry cook,
mm-hmm.
for some reason, he would clearly have just ended up like as a private security guy. There's no reason he should be a fry cook.
He's just so built. He looks so silly in that little apron. It's like a gag, him even being there, and he's not there for very long. Someone shows up and offers him a job. You know the drill. Get into the casino, get the money, and we'll split it. Even Stevens. Or
75-25, actually. But yeah, get in before the nuke drops. And, you know, nuke drops in 4 days. We're going to get you in there 32 hours. Why exactly 32? Why cut it that close? I don't know.
You got to devote an entire day to assembling the team and giving everyone their quippy introductions.
Yeah, so
you can't rush these things. There's an art to it.
There's an art to making a movie 2.5 hours long when it could have been 110 minutes.
Yeah, there's a lot of movie-length discourse on fucking Twitter these days that I don't care to take a side on. Some movies are too long. Some movies are too short. I venture to say that happens less often, but maybe I'm just getting old and cranky.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there. So, yeah, we meet the whole team. We meet his buddy Vandero, who is played by Omari Hardwick. He's got a big fucking circular saw. We see him chewing zombies up with that during the montage, and then mm-hmm. he gets like startlingly little use out of it when
right.
the shit hits the fan in the movie proper, which is a fucking shame.
Tegan Notaro plays a helicopter pilot.
Yeah,
this recruit.
If you follow movie headlines, apparently this was Chris D'Elia originally,
and then was digitally disappeared.
Yeah, he was disappeared because, you know, he's been canceled. Multiple harassment, possibly assault allegation. I don't know the details because whatever, fuck him. But yeah, Tignataro was swapped in digitally at apparently the cost of millions of dollars.
And it's not as uncanny as you'd expect most of the time.
Most of the time.
It helps that her character winds up stranded on a rooftop by herself for half the movie.
Right.
So that's a good fortune for the filmmakers, I guess.
Other than that, you know, there's obviously a fair number of like digitally composited shots where she's in with other people, but then it's just a lot of like one shots of her like
reacting to stuff,
etc. And it looks fine.
Zack Snyder kind of lucked out here too. I'm planning to complain about this more after the break. For some reason, the way this movie is shot, there's such a shallow depth of field.
There's a lot of blur.
You'll have just a regular two shot, you know, two heads in the frame, people talking. And they're basically, their heads are occupying the same amount of space, same amount of screen real estate. They're standing effectively side by side, and one of them will just be a big blurry smear, just like wildly out of focus. And so I imagine it's easier to composite someone into a shot like that when you're just dealing with pea soup.
Yeah, there is a lot of, even when it's not that bad, it's still like the corners of most shots have that kind of blur to them.
It made me feel like I was on the verge of passing out, like my vision was irising in, and I was about to wake up in the back of an ambulance or something.
We meet Maria, who's an old friend of Dave Bautista's, and she's like running a junkyard or something, a car repair place. Yeah, I mean, you know, he rounds up the whole team. He gets told he has to find a safe cracker for obvious reasons, so he meets this excitable German named Dieter, because of course his name is Dieter. And then the last member of the team they find is some yokel from YouTube who does like trick shots on crowds of zombies, like, oh, double headshot with one bullet, oh, triple, whoa!
Yeah, total ponage.
Yeah.
And so he brings along a few members of his squad.
Yeah, I think just two, and one of them
bails immediately.
Yeah, before, you know, as soon as he gets the load, I'm like, wait, zombies? you really didn't tell them? Like, what the fuck?
Right.
So, yeah, they assemble the squad, they get the lowdown from the rich guy, and find out that the rich guy's security leader, played by Garrett Dillahunt, has to come along with them. Everybody's eyes are on him, and for good reason, because duh, of course he's a plant.
Yeah, he's predictably up to no good.
Yeah.
Last two recruits arrive in the form of a woman named Lily, who is a coyote. It's not like a literal CGI coyote.
No.
Or a CGI zombie coyote, as the case may be.
No.
She has been ferrying people.
It's in an illegal border crosser.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that sort of coyote.
Yeah, she's been leading people in and out of the quarantine zone. There's an internment camp of sorts set up on the fringes of Las Vegas, where she's been operating. There's a few people being bussed out to get them out of the blast radius.
Yeah, they're emptying a camp out. And the other final member of the team is Dave Bautista's character's name is Scott. I don't think we mentioned this. It'll be quicker to say that rather than Dave Bautista. Scott's daughter, Kate, from whom he is estranged, because of course he is a volunteer at this camp. Helps women and just people in general in the camp.
Yeah, and by this point we have seen Scott having a flashback nightmare about him tearfully stabbing his zombie wife in the head while his daughter looks on in horror. So this has something to do with their estrangement.
Yes. And we've also met a scummy camp guard named Cummings, who...
Gross. I didn't know that was his name.
Yes.
I did not internalize that somehow. Well, okay, so this guy joins the team. The coyote is like, we need one more guy. Yeah, we for sure need exactly one more guy. You don't know what it's like in there. We need another guy. Most definitely. Yeah.
Let's get another guy. How about we get another guy?
You feeling? It's like she's asking everyone if they're feeling tacos for dinner as opposed to like Mediterranean.
You know,
another guy? One more guy?
One more round? Another round of drinks?
That is the delivery. So like there's something shifty going on there. And then yeah, she ropes this shitbag into it. And I'm thinking, okay, he is obviously a huge liability. He's going to have some heel turn once they're in the war zone and put everyone's life in danger. This is only worth it if he immediately gets torn to pieces. And that was the one moment where the movie kind of read my mind a little bit, for which I was thankful.
Yeah.
We'll touch on that shortly.
We will indeed. The reason Kate wants to go in is because Lily smuggled some camp resident acquaintance of Kate's in to, I don't know, find money somewhere in order to...
Just regular looting, I assume.
Right.
I don't think they're planning to crack into a bank vault.
No.
or a hotel vault.
Yeah, in order to get money together to bribe her and her kids' way out of the camp and etc. So that's why Kate demands to go. She wants to go find this woman. So they go inside, and once they open the container to get inside the perimeter, there's just a bunch of, like, dried out zombies piled up.
Like cicada husks, just kind of drying in the sun.
And apparently this is what happened to shamblers. That's what the dumb zombies are called.
Hey,
apparently,
the terminology in these goddamn movies.
I agree. They were too dumb to get out of the sun, so they just kind of dried out and collapsed. And supposedly when it rains, on the few occasions it rains around Vegas, they come back to life.
Yeah, they sponge up the moisture.
And Dieter very pointedly, and I think reasonably, asks, how much rain? What does it take? He gets ignored, of course.
Of course.
Because he's very jumpy, and people like to make fun of him.
Yeah. Shiza. He says Shiza whenever an event happens in this movie. Good, bad, Shiza. That's just, it's incessant. And this is sort of the zombies sponging up the rain and being resurrected is a little bit of a broken promise. I wasn't expecting like a fucking tropical storm to break out
right
in this movie in the midst of an atomic bomb dropping. But that is still a kind of neat idea that is just given lip service and then never comes up in a material way. So just sort of disappointing.
Right. So Lily gets the drop on the scummy camp guard and basically hog ties him and presents him as tribute to the smart zombies.
Mm-hmm. An emissary of the smart zombies comes up, and I know that you were taking umbrage with a lot of the like Mad Maxification of the zombie society.
Yes.
I thought her look was kind of cool just because she is done up in this Thunderdome way, but it's also chintzy and Vegas at the same time. She's like a rhinestone high priestess.
Well, yeah,
I thought that was kind of funny.
Looks like a 70s showgirl.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of get up.
So she shows up, and
there's also a zombie tiger.
Oh yes, named Valentine.
Which apparently it was one of Siegfried and Roy's tigers, and now it's a zombie tiger. And Garrett Dillahunt doesn't like it, and neither do I. We can get into that after the break.
So the high priestess or the queen or whatever she is deems the tribute to be satisfactory, and she hauls off the pervert asshole, drags him into the dust. And then they basically established this shaky truce, and Coyote says, we got to get off the streets. These are their streets. We got to move this party indoors, which they proceed to do. They're maneuvering through this crowded building that's just crammed with hibernating zombies who are just asleep standing up in this bovine kind of way.
Yes.
They're all, and a lot of them are posed like with their arms kind of outstretched and their fingers groping. It looks
claw-like.
Like it looks like a Frozen thriller flash mob, like that's about to go off in the mall, and you're like, oh fuck me, I gotta get out of here. So they start gingerly picking their way through the throng, trying not to wake up any of the sleeping beauties. And the viral star's second in command is bringing up the rear. It was going to be Garrett Dillahunt, the corporate stooge, but she's like, nah, I don't trust you. You walk ahead of me.
And so he immediately fucks her over. Dave Bautista's laying down glow sticks in order to lead people through because they're not supposed to use their light and wake up the zombies. Garrett Dillahunt immediately takes one and like throws it off in a different direction to throw her off and fuck her over. This culminates, of course, in her like having to kill a couple of zombies and thinking she gets away with it, but she set one down next to some pots and pans.
Yeah, there's a zombie with its hand draped over a bunch of pans, which then clatter to the floor as it starts to rouse itself from its slumber.
They need to get the hell out, and everybody does except the chick who got lost. Garrett Dillahunt bars the door in front of her. And
this whole scene plays out very much like Aliens. She looks exactly like Vasquez with the red bandana on her forehead, and then he gets his Burke moment when he seals her doom, and it's not his last Burke moment by any means.
Right. In the end, she does like burst through some windows and look like she's going to make it, and then she gets bitten by some other zombies anyway. Mm-hmm. So she gets left behind. They run off, and here we go again.
The guy who was taken captive before Cummings, he's dragged in front of the zombie king and given a non-fatal bite. Basically, they've established at this point that if you get bitten by the head honcho, you become one of the smart ones, like one of his inner circle, or an alpha, as they call it. And so that's what's being done to him. And during this scene, the big cheese zombie kneels down in front of the aforementioned rhinestone Tina Turner zombie and listens to her belly. His face indicates that he's pleased by what he hears, which suggests that
there is a zombie fetus.
Zack Snyder is pursuing his perverse fascination with zombie fetuses as far as it can possibly go. It's another holdover from Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah, and we'll get more into that after the break, but it's not quite so perverse in Dawn of the Dead.
They find some blueprints showing the floor plan of the casino and the layout of the vault and everything. Oh shit, we're not the first team he sent in here. Did you know anything about this, Mr. Dillahunt? No. What? No, he doesn't tell me. I'm just head of security. He's got me on a strictly need-to-know basis. I never saw hide nor hair of him. Okay. They all appear to buy that for some reason, instead of just instantly
shooting him in the face.
Fragging him, yeah, like it's Nom. Turning on their commanding officer. So they get the power running to the casino. Lights come up on the floor. Cheesy music starts playing. All the slot machines come to life. They make it into the basement. They have to circumvent some security systems, which are very Temple of Doom, I thought. I mean, the last one is just two enormous pistons that smash together.
The bait zombie that they push through.
Yeah, right. And
first, it's a bunch of darts, and then it's fucking guns come out of the wall. And then, yeah, it's just wall smashers.
So then Dieter gets to work on the vault. They find out that the deadline for the nuke has been moved up. It was supposed to be a 4th of July event. They've bumped it up to the 3rd of July just to pull the rug out from under our protagonists, even though that's obviously way less thematically fitting.
Yeah, so they were supposed to have 25 and a half hours from about this point to detonation, and instead they have an hour and a half.
The corporate plant has, at this point, we realize that he has a side deal with the coyote. He claims the head of the queen zombie, which is more than she thought he was going to do. She said, I thought you just needed a vial of her blood. He has this ulterior motive that he's basically bringing out a chemical weapon.
Yeah, they're going to develop alpha zombies that can be controlled, because that would totally work. Idea as old as the hills.
Yeah, it's like fucking Vincent D'Onofrio trying to train raptors. It's like, what the hell?
Fuck you.
So he puts her head in a duffel bag. Head is still living. He hasn't harmed the brain at all. Just severed it from its shoulders. And her death cry has echoed far and wide. So the rest of the smart zombies know that something's up. They get the vault open. It's a scene that's striving for die-hard grandeur. But it's not Ode to Joy playing. It's Wagner, because it's a German safecracker.
Right. And the fucking safe, lest we forget, is called Götterdämmerung.
And he rhapsodizes about this at some length with a dreamy look in his eye.
It could be death or rebirth on the other side of that door. It's money, you fucking asshole. It's just money.
It's a lot of money. In a sense, death is waiting for them, because the shit proceeds to hit the fan. You know, they get the money into the sacks and they're about to hoof it up to the roof, where Tignataro is waiting, having been basically hitting a helicopter with a wrench for the last 40 minutes of screen time.
Yes.
Trying to get it repaired. So a lot of suspense kind of goes out the window here, because they're cutting it way too close. Dave Bautista says something like, we got 20 minutes until this place is just a bunch of rubble and glass, or words to that effect. It's definitely 20 minutes. I remember the figure.
Yeah.
If not the exact.
Until this place is dust.
Yes.
That's the term.
Dust is the term. You're correct.
They're trying to hoof $200 million in cash. Seven people.
Uh-huh.
That takes a long fucking time. $200 million in cash, even if it's all hundreds, is literally tons of money. Like, it's just, it's a lot of fucking weight.
To say nothing of the fact that, you know, if they sprinted up to the, if they said fuck the money and sprinted to the rooftop, you don't even, and when you're in light aircraft, you don't really want to be in the same postal code as a mushroom cloud, you know?
No.
I mean, they're toast. Their goose is cooked, even if everything went according to plan, which obviously it doesn't, because it's a heist movie and a zombie movie. You know?
Right.
Best laid plans. So, all hell breaks loose. They waste more time, in addition to this situation feeling highly unreal already, just because they're way too pressed for time. They proceed to fritter it away in small ways. There's a lot of like high fives and slaps on the back when they get the vault open.
A little bit of making it rain.
Yeah, right. Literally. And then Scott and Maria have a little bit of a tender moment where she wants to rekindle this romance that they have. I didn't come here for the money. I came here for you. It's like, okay, let's talk about it on the helicopter. Let's get the show on the road.
We only have to wait 20 minutes.
And then in the snideriest, edgelordiest moment in the whole movie, right after they've had this heart-to-heart, she gets her head exorcised by a zombie. He, like, spins it around 180 degrees, and her fucking, like, a CGI collarbone or a vertebrae or something comes poking out of her neck.
Yeah, more after the break.
Oh, yeah.
Meanwhile, Garrett Dillahunt, who has locked them inside, has fucked off with what he thinks is the zombie queen's head. The coyote has swapped it for like a cash counter that apparently weighs about the same. So he's like, oh, fuck. And then he encounters the zombie tiger and proceeds to endure a fucking DiCaprio in The Revenant bear scene.
It's really protracted. And that can be gratifying when you're seeing a villain get his just desserts. I'm stuck on Jurassic Park today, as I am most days. I'm thinking of like Peter Stormare in Lost World.
Sure.
Who takes about half an hour to die, if memory serves. You know.
Yeah.
And so when you've got it coming, you've got it coming. But also, we got a schedule to keep. You know, the bombs are about to fall.
Let's get it over with.
Right. So the tiger goes toe-to-toe with him in a parking garage. They do fucking 9 rounds. And then, obviously, he dies, because he's fighting a zombie tiger.
Yes.
Turns his head into mush.
Vandero and Dieter get separated from the remainder of the team, which at this point is just YouTube chucklefuck Scott and the coyote.
His daughter has gone off to do her own side mission already.
Wandered off to go
point.
Rescue her friend from the camp. But Dieter and Vandero are like stuck there. Vandero's basically like, get behind me, but wordlessly. It's dramatic. And he goes toe-to-toe with the Alpha, who we've elided some of this, but by this point, we have not only seen that in addition to a zombie tiger, there's also a zombie horse.
Mm-hmm.
And the Alpha, or the King, because the others are Alphas too, I guess, the King, whatever, rides this fucking zombie horse and has spent most of the movie with a cape and now has a fucking like metal half helm. Looking like the Phantom of the Paradise.
It looks exactly like the Phantom of the Paradise visor, and the cape looks dorky as hell. I think the horse looks cool. The flesh has been flayed from its face, so it's like a skeletal horse face atop this desiccated, decaying horse body. I was here for that. He looks like a fucking loser. You could put him on the coolest horse in the world, and he would still just look like an absolute moron, like Renaissance fair dweeb. The cape is embarrassing, and the helmet is not much better.
Yeah. So Vandero goes toe-to-toe with him.
And this is his big last stand, and yeah, his circular saw is nowhere in sight.
Yeah.
Fucking the coyote has it for some reason. She uses it to get out
cut
of,
them a hole
yeah,
on and, the way out.
Right, exactly. Escape from the predicament that Burke stranded them in.
Eventually, Vandero looks like he's about to die, and then Dieter distracts the King and then tosses Vandero in the vault and closes it behind him. Gets wrecked as the vault is closing, of course. So we're down to 3. They're hightailing it for the elevator because they had to go through a different other elevator.
Uh-huh.
And shit is hitting the fan. They're on the casino floor. Yeah. There's a bunch of alphas running around.
Yeah, they finally we get the kind of spectacle, the shootout on the casino floor. I thought way more of the movie was going to look like this with the 52 pickup, you know, with dollar bills raining from the sky and cards going everywhere.
Chips
and tables being flipped over and zombies eating shit in a million different ways. So this movie had burnt a lot of goodwill at this point, but I was kind of looking forward to set pieces like this one, and it lasts a regrettably short amount of time. Although, as I keep saying, we are pressed for time at this point. They kind of have to put the pedal to the metal.
Yeah. YouTube guy eats shit and gets to blow himself up with some grenades, as you do. And Scott and the coyote make it to the elevator and head up to the roof. There's a minor delay while Tignataro gets the fucking chopper going. And then Dave Bautista's getting in, and then...
Again, everyone's all smiles, pacing themselves. It's like they're running late for a movie, but they know that there's 15 minutes of trailers, so it's no big deal.
On cue, the fucking king makes it to the roof,
mm-hmm.
and so the coyote, rather than... Okay, so she pulls out the head and holds it hostage, holds a gun to it. And rather than getting in the chopper in the course of this, which she totally could have done, she's like, no... Go without me. I'll hold him here. You could do both.
Right.
Eventually, she gets impaled with a piece of rebar.
Yeah, he harpoons her, which is admittedly kind of cool.
Yeah. Chopper gets away. She dangles the head over the ledge on the side of the building, and as he's coming closer, drops it, splat,
yeah,
on the
splats,
street below.
Splats like a watermelon.
So, they're flying away, and they've got about 9 minutes now, apparently. Mm-hmm. And Kate, who has been working her way through the zombies' home base hotel for some time now and has found her friend and two other camp escapees, soon to be one, incidentally.
Yes.
Now they're being chased by alphas and by the king, who has descended the main casino and gone over there.
And by one alpha in particular, the tribute from earlier, who has dropped out of the movie and now come back hungry for blood.
Yeah. Tignataro drops Dave Bautista off on the roof of the zombies' home base. And as you would expect, Kate's doing some work with the pistol, shooting some alphas, killing some guys. And then as like 14 other people in the fucking movie have to do up to this point, tries to shoot the king in the head. And mm-hmm.
The Phantom of the Paradise.
Pling, pling. Just fucking metal helmet. It's not going to happen. But Dad shows up just in time and... proceeds to miss with a grenade launcher, but the grenade like lands close enough to where the king gets knocked off to the side or something, stunned briefly.
Yeah, it's some Power Rangers nonsense.
They go up to the roof, and they're, again, taking their sweet-ass time once they're on the roof. It starts out like, oh no, she left us. And then, of course, she didn't. We hear the chopper noise.
Tig had a crisis of conscience. Comes back, tells them as much. It's not like a very rousing, oh, the Han Solo shows up to save the day moment. It's a foregone conclusion, and then it plays out very laboriously. And so finally, with seconds to spare, it feels like the bomb should have gone off 20 minutes ago.
Yes.
They get on the chopper, and then it's so weird because this is our second rooftop helicopter King Zombie standoff. In the span of like 8 minutes, it's the exact same scene, the exact same situation. This time there's no hostage crisis, obviously, because the head was splatted like a watermelon. So he charges at the chopper like fucking Captain America and takes a dive after it, grabs onto it. He and Bautista are wrestling inside of the chopper. Tig gets shot in the arm in the scuffle, and then the helicopter skims the ground. Oh no, they're gonna crash. And then they make it over the shipping container wall and into the desert as the missile is going the opposite way, blows the city off the map, and then the helicopter gets caught in the blast radius in the atomic winds and crashes horribly, killing almost everyone on board. Bautista shoots the king zombie in the head, and his head comes apart, and there's a bunch of blue goop on the inside, I guess designating him as the main head on the Hydra, or whatever you want to call it, the big brain in the middle of this hive mind.
In the course of this scuffle, of course, Dave Bautista gets bit, and so after the helicopter crash, when Kate is, like, thrown free, which I wouldn't imagine would have ended well for her, but okay, apparently she made it.
No, I mean, no one walks away from a crash like that.
No.
But...
Tig has been impaled by part of a rotor blade toast.
We don't even see the woman that
from
Kate
the camp
rescued. We don't lay eyes on her once in this whole...
Nope, not even a corpse.
Well, because it's just so indicative of Snyder's priorities. You know, he doesn't actually give a shit about this rescue operation. It's so callous. If she had made it, then there would be some kind of lofty, like, Saving Private Ryan kind of element to all of this. Where, like, yes, everyone died, but they got their guy. And he doesn't even care enough to show us her body. She's just a total non-entity.
We'll get into it more after the break.
Uh-huh.
In any case, we have the sort of tearful, like, reconciliation, but also, you know, I know what this means. I'm going to die, blah, blah, blah. Sure enough, he dies and then comes back and she has to shoot him. And then another chopper shows up from somewhere and is there to rescue her. Our coda is... We see the rubble of Vegas at night. Looks like fucking nuclear winter in there. And
it looks like Fallout New Vegas.
And Vandero climbs out of the rubble. I guess found his way out of the vault somehow with a bunch of money.
Clawed his way up through hundreds of tons of detritus.
Walks through just miles of irradiated wasteland.
Mm-hmm.
Makes it back somehow.
Without puking up his own entrails.
All right, makes it back to his trailer or something.
Blistering over 90% of his body.
Gets in his car, drives to an airport, charters a private jet, and then he's hanging out with the stewardesses and having a toast, and then suddenly he looks a little wobbly.
Uh-huh.
And he gets himself to the bathroom.
Probably the fucking Pripyat sickness getting to him, I thought. Well, but no, I said out loud, the hack move here would be for him to have a zombie bite. And be the new patient zero.
And that's exactly what it is.
Yeah. And it's such whiplash, too, because the coda up till this point has played like a really long-winded version of the end of Con Air with Steve Buscemi getting away scot-free. And so that's kind of delightful. But then, yeah, you got to end on your sour note. Snyder did the same thing in Dawn of the Dead, saved it for in the middle of the credits, you know, actually... What's that fucking Simpsons gag? So-and-so died on the way back to his home planet. That's how the end of this fucking movie feels. And Dawn of the Dead, although that movie has more going for it. More on that, I'm sure, after the break.
What the...
They're not what you think they are. They're smarter. They're faster. They're organized.
The best that you can hope for is to die.
Oh, scheiße.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. Podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
You got to know the whole, know when to fold.
Zombie tiger.
That's crossing the line.
And we're back. So, I had, and I told Matt this just prior to our watching this movie when we were on the way back from lunch, I have an ideological opposition to some of the main principles of this movie, and I had it going in. And when I say principles, I don't mean like Snyder's politics, whatever you want to say those are. I mean like the mechanics of the zombies. Smart zombies can fuck right off, is what I say. It's one thing to have, like, the back half of the Romero tetralogy, Day of the Dead and Land of the Dead, where they're sort of reacquiring rudimentary like memories of intelligence, if that makes sense.
Well, and even in Land of the Dead, it's one zombie in a million that's capable of thinking tactically and assembling an army.
Right. And in this movie, the zombies are like strategizing on how to corner this team of human beings, and they're running around doing fucking parkour shit.
Uh-huh. Kind of barking at each other. Again, stuck on Jurassic Park, like raptors giving like all that stuff.
Yeah, they have this fucking society and hierarchy. They have a fucking king who has a tiger and a horse.
And an heir. He's siring heirs. We didn't talk about the scene where he extricates what's left of his...
A blue zombie fetus.
Yeah, the blue gooey zombie fetus. It looks like the same stuff that comes gooshing out of his brain at the end of the movie, out of his skull.
Yeah, extracts this fetus from the body of his queen, rips it out, you know. And fuck all of that. Just fuck it right to hell.
Is it the influence of Game of Thrones, you think? Is it like a White Walker thing? Because I haven't seen, but I was getting like White Walker vibes from some of the fucking palace intrigue, you know, with him and his queen and his court. I don't think you even get that much, White Walker politics.
No, you don't really get any White Walker politics. You have the, what do they call him? The Night King, who's like the leader of the White Walkers, but you just see him showing up. He's an elemental opponent. He's just the personification of the rest of them, essentially. There's not like... Who are his main minions, you know? Does the Night King have a Night Queen?
Yeah, who's his vizier?
None of that.
Who's
bullshit.
The power behind the throne?
So I think this is all just Snyder being like, you know, it'd be really cool if the zombies had a king. Fuck you. Get the fuck out. I'm sorry this critique is not very nuanced, but I have an inborn hostility to this idea. It's just asinine.
I'm sick of zombie media in general, and so that makes me about the furthest thing from a zombie purist as you could ever hope to find. So I'm less put off by all that. I still don't like the way it's executed all that much. I think this sort of thing probably peaked in Day of the Dead with Bub, is that his name? Who, it's one zombie who starts out, you know, just as this lurching, and then you get to spend a lot of time with him, and you see his conditioning at the hands of the Frankenstein, whatever his actual name is.
Right.
And they call him Frankenstein because the zombie, Bub, is kind of Karloffian. You know, he has this slow coming to his senses arc over the course of the movie where there's, you know, kind of a noble spirit in there, but he's still monstrous and kind of pathetic and pitiable. And it feels very universal horror, you know, because Romero is old school that way.
Right.
And that's one thing. I agree that when the zombies are just like a big ant colony comprised of parkour aficionados, it does kind of wear thin.
It's just tedious.
I was here for more of the road warrior aesthetics than you were. I still thought the mask and the cape looked fucking dopey. But I liked the horse. I liked the tiger. I don't care so much about... I'm actually eager to get away from the zombie rule book, provided it's done in a way that's novel and not just like, okay, this is different, but it's not. There's a difference between something just being not the same and something being actually different in a way that's pronounced and kind of fresh. I mean, what I really am craving at this point, my zombie fatigue has gotten to the point where I really need you to think more outside of the box than this movie does. And a case in point for me there would be the tar zombie from Return of the Living Dead, where it just looks like no other zombie you've ever seen. It's just dripping with this strange black ichor. It's got these bulging, almost cartoonish white eyes, this grinning mouth, and it literally says, "Brains!" You know, I mean, that's classic, of course, but now it is. I mean, everyone attributes that just to zombies en masse, even though it's, I think, from that movie specifically.
I think so, yeah.
But he's weird looking and genuinely freakish. And so when you show me a zombie tiger or a zombie horse with its face all missing, I think, okay, that we're getting there. What else you got? And the movie just doesn't have any other tricks up its sleeve. They're basically just fast zombies out of 28 Days Later for the most part, but with more of like the simian parkour jumping, the quadrupedal movement of... I don't know. When did that start to happen? I feel like that started to happen around the time that 28 Days Later changed the game.
Well, yeah, and not to mention, the zombies in Snyder's Dawn of the Dead are also fast.
Right.
But, I don't know, again, it just, they're fast in a less irritating way. And frankly, and this is just, this is me going in the opposite direction of Matt and, like, hewing too close to what, like, my mental rule book of how these things are supposed to work, but I'm going to vent about it anyway. 28 Days Later, the way I square that in my head is that...
Are you one of those pedants who are like, they're not zombies, they're infected?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I'd, like, hew to a particular terminology or other, but basically, they're not dead.
Yeah.
They're just, sure, infected. We'll go with that. They're infected. They do stuff. But if you're trying to pitch me on the idea that walking corpses, people who have died and then have come back to a sort of unlife and are rotting as they walk around, don't tell me that they're getting smarter.
And stronger.
And stronger and faster. And they're also reproducing.
Uh-huh.
They are fucking and making a baby. Go to hell. That is dumb as shit.
Yeah, it's pretty out there. I mean, the one innovation from 28 Days Later that everyone latched onto, obviously, is just to make the zombies fast. And that's the thing that I like most about 28 Days Later is that it taps into a fear of a viral pathogen, you know, and that if you get a drop of zombie blood on your eyeball or, you know, in a cut on the back of your hand or whatever, or a bit of zombie saliva lands in your ear canal somehow, you're donezo. Just like any infection point, and your goose is cooked. You're out of commission.
Right.
That, and the best thing about that, Jim, is that it doesn't allow any time for goddamn tearful goodbyes. You have to be very unsentimental in 28 Days Later. You have to think fast and be lightning quick with your executions, or you're going to be next. And that's some scary shit. And better even than scary, it's not maudlin. And yeah. Zombie movies, would-be tearjerker scenes in zombie movies are some of the worst written scenes in the annals of film history. I don't know what it is. For some reason, it's worse than any war movie I've ever seen when someone's, you know, been gut shot and they're like,
I'm not
going to
make it, Cap.
Yeah, like that, I can deal with a certain amount of cheese. For some reason, when you've sustained a zombie bite, you could deliver the exact same speech and I'll be in the audience just blowing raspberries, like not even listening. I just don't care. It's too stupid. And that's just my own bias and my zombie media fatigue talking. I have almost no patience for it. Peninsula pulled a fucking miracle out of its ass with getting away with that as much as it did. And even then, my appreciation of that movie and how drawn out that climax was kind of just, I was still at a bit of a remove. I wasn't like getting worked up emotionally.
Right.
You know, I was still like, this is ridiculous, but in a way that I find myself enjoying. When Snyder lays it on, there's no mirth or like self-aware appreciation in it at all. It's very much trying to jerk tears out of you. And I don't know, it might be like a little funny on purpose, because Dave Bautista, there's this running joke throughout the movie where he wants to open a food truck with his millions, you know?
Right?
And so he keeps spitballing ideas with his daughter. It's the one thing they bond over when they're in the thick of it. And as he's dying, he's talking about the menu on his hypothetical artisanal food truck. But it's one of those, like, cheesy, I'm trying to think of what to compare it to. He's just harking.
This gag has been done.
Yes. Yeah, to death. And I can't even tell if it's supposed to be funny or not, because Snyder, when he tries to crank up the pathos, it just turns into Batman v Superman a little bit. You know, it's just it's a dirge-like lament. it's just a joyless experience. And he occasionally does have an eye, like when the camera pulls out and you see the burning wreckage of the helicopter and the mushroom cloud in the background and Kate cradling her father's corpse. You know, if that was the last shot of a good movie, I would, it would be kind of arresting and kind of, it would be a good note to go out on. Then, of course, you would get the stupid coda with what's his name on the plane, and he doesn't do the noble thing and off himself. It's like, okay, buddy, time to join the Mile Die Club. Doesn't happen. He just looks in the mirror and says, fuck. And that's the note we go out on, a witless F-bomb,
yeah,
cut to black.
Indeed. And this speaks to the broader issue of tone and tonal whiplash. I mean, I even talked about it in the context of just the opening credits montage alone.
Yes.
It goes from Richard Cheese jokey jokes to, oh no, this woman and her daughter, they didn't quite make it. And then they get bitten and, oh no. And then they get squashed by a fucking falling shipping container.
Ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. A-ba-deep-a-deep-a-dip. That's all, folks.
So there's that. We go from, oh, the YouTube guy's doing something funny to, oh, somebody died. I don't know. I mean, this is not to say that you can't have a zombie movie or a movie of this ilk where there's humor and then bad stuff happens. And it can even be abrupt sometimes and mm-hmm. still work. But whatever that takes to do that properly, I guess Zack Snyder just doesn't have it because it feels like whiplash every goddamn time.
And it's not even the kind of violent whiplash where it's unpleasant because you feel yourself being jerked from one mode to the next. It happens often enough that it's just kind of deadening overall.
Right.
Like, it does these swerves and you don't even feel it. I mean, you don't feel the turbulence. It's just smooth sailing because you're totally uninvested in what's happening.
Right.
That's the real problem.
Yeah, it's not a, like, you know, you're invested in this character or whatever, and then the rug gets pulled out from under you, and you're like, oh, fuck. None of that. No. It's just like, oh, and now it's supposed to be funny, and then, oh, well, somebody's dead. And then, hallelujah. The Leonard Cohen track, Hallelujah, does not actually play in this movie. But,
no.
You know, it's from Snyder's bag of tricks. So
it's funny when I watched Watchmen in theaters, that scene, you know, I thought, like, God, they should have gone with a cover. There's a fucking shit zillion covers of Hallelujah out there. It's like one of the most covered songs of all time. Why would you go with, like, the least sexy one you could possibly find? I get that it's the original, nothing but respect to the late great Leonard, but yeah, like, that should have been a cover. And then I had the opposite reaction, the exact inverse reaction, when I saw Justice League. I was like, oh, well, they should have done the Leonard Cohen version of Everybody Knows. That would have been way better. So it's just like, the man just
has no feel.
He's just missing tricks left and right, at least from where I'm sitting. Your mileage may vary, as per usual. The whiplash is so chronic. I'll try to give you an example of what I mean by this and what I was getting at the very top of the episode, where I said that this movie strives for a little bit of that breezy Dawn of the Dead levity that Snyder has basically totally lost his knack for. During the pitch session where they're meeting with the shadowy mogul and he's talking about the mission, the heist.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
There's this slow-mo shot of them, you know, here's how it's going to go. And, you know, we see the mission playing out optimally with them just laying waste to the zombie horde, not even getting a scratch on them, just being super cool, badass action dudes. And then the Kraut is like, wait a minute. And everything pauses and it turns into like Deadpool for a second. And he's like, point of order. Like, what about this? And he like looks to the camera, I think. Maybe not.
Maybe
like past the camera.
Yeah.
And they deal with this, and then it unpauses, and there's everything short of a record scratch moment. It's really kind of appalling. And it would work if there was like kind of a bright color palette and it was punched up in little ways, but the whole movie just has the color palette of Man of Steel, with a few exceptions. Like when they're on the casino floor, you finally get away from that a little bit, and it's a breath of fresh air.
Even outside the casino floor, it's a little bit less pallid than Man of Steel, I would say. But it's certainly not. We're not watching a Nick Reffin movie, you know. we're not seeing a lot of like Vegas neon,
right? No, which I'm over anyway because the '80s nostalgia cycle has played itself out as far as I'm concerned. But the fact remains: the gunmetal gray drabness of Man of Steel is present in this movie to a kind of obnoxious degree. And I think that saps a lot of the fun out of it and makes these would-be moments of whimsy feel really grating and out of place. Omari Hardwick has a couple monologues that are also meant to be funny but don't register that way at all. He's like joking in this kind of would-be fourth wall breaking way. I keep saying would-be when I'm talking about Zack Snyder because I can only think about ways in which he's coming up short. He has these fourth wall breaking monologues about like, oh, this is about time for the big third act twist, the mind bending reveal. And I thought he was actually like about to betray them or something.
Well, no,
because that's just the tone that's being struck.
No, when this happens, they like find the corpses of one of the prior teams that came in here to get the money that they're trying to get. And the corpses, from what little can be identified of them, this one's wearing a bandana and this one's got sunglasses. I don't fucking know. And then we montage our way through like all the members of this team and like, oh, this could be this person. This could be this person. And then he goes on this like 90-second monologue about
this Edge of Tomorrow sci-fi scenario where like they were the other teams that got sent in.
And I said, like, multiple times during this monologue, audibly, I'm looking at Matt, and I'm like, I swear to God, if this isn't a joke, fuck this movie, we can't finish it. Or, like, when we record the podcast, it's going to be 30 seconds long, and it's just going to be Zack Snyder, fuck you.
Yeah, I would have.
Thankfully,
I would have just turned into the warty old lady from Princess Bride going, boo, boo. I would have just done that until you cut the recording.
Thankfully, that at least doesn't happen. But yeah, he has a bunch of these like weird monologues.
He gets another one at the very end of the movie when he's toasting with the stewardesses.
Yeah, talking about Joseph Campbell once said, it's like, fuck you, Zack Snyder. Have you read Joseph Campbell? Kiss my ass.
Well, and it's just, you said it best. You said, if this isn't a joke, then fuck this movie. We can't finish it. On and on. The fact that you even had to wonder, it was like flip a coin. Is it a joke or isn't it? It's impossible to tell because Snyder's movies have gotten so drab and joyless, even when they're supposed to be these balls to the wall, colorful action romps like this movie appeared to be.
Wanted to be.
Yeah. It's just, when the first teaser for Man of Steel dropped, I don't know if you remember, it's just a shot of like a kid out in a backyard in Kansas, you know, wearing like a red towel around his neck. It's kind of an evocative teaser. You know, you see like laundry hanging up, mm-hmm, and a dog and a sunset. And
the dog's hanging up too.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's the Leatherface farm from Texas Chainsaw. The whole thing is kind of, a lot of people were really struck by it. Like, oh, this looks kind of arty. This is going to be good. And I had an inkling of that feeling, but I also felt a contrary emotion, which I expressed to a friend of mine. I said, this looks like if Terrence Malick directed a Toyota commercial. You know, there was just something a little, and you said this a couple episodes ago. I can't remember the movie now. When Dave Bautista and the first woman he recruits are drinking beers in her junkyard, it looks like Clint Eastwood is about to start grumbling about how it's halftime in America.
I think that was Assimilate just two episodes ago.
Yes, that was. And there we were just making fun of like the bullshit color grading,
yeah,
and how it makes everything look way grayer than it has any right to look on a bright, sunny summer day. Here, it looks exactly like that, but just throughout. I mean, it looks very much like a Toyota commercial.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I mean, when Snyder tries to set up like his take on Americana, you know, like two friends drinking beers on top of a trashed car, it doesn't look like this authentic blue collar thing. It looks corporate somehow. It looks like it's been processed and like I'm being sold something, you know, like, okay, is this insurance? Is this an antidepressant commercial? Where is this going? Is it for, I don't know. It there's just something about it that's kind of, sanitized isn't the right word. I don't know exactly what I'm trying to say. Toothless, I guess. Just something about it that feels terrifically insincere, which is why I keep likening it to TV commercials, where you just kind of feel like if you're being taken in by it, then you're being swindled somehow, or like your higher faculties have failed you.
Sure. You're not as smart as the alpha zombies.
Right. Yeah. Who would scoff at the Halftime in America Super Bowl ad, surely. Being so brainy with their bright blue
brains. There's one zombie that we see who inexplicably has like glowing blue eyes, like he is a White Walker.
Yeah, that was bizarre.
It shows up once and never again. I don't know why. In the same scene that Matt was complaining about a little while ago with the freeze frame, wait a moment, you know, like about 90 seconds after that, the villain, the casino owner, played, as I believe I said at the top, by Hiroyuki Sanada, who, if you can't tell from his name, is Japanese.
Oh, yeah.
He says,
I forgot about this.
He wraps up by, you know, like explaining how simple it's going to be. And he says, easy peasy Japanese. And then Dieter, this Aryan motherfucker, is like giving him a lecture on political correctness. Like, I don't think we can say that anymore. You have to say lemon squeezy.
Because he's up on all the American idioms.
and everybody just kind of stops. And like, it's supposed to be, I don't know, Zack Snyder dunking on woke culture or something. But in addition to all the characters stopping basically to groan, it also makes the audience groan. And not even really at Dieter, but at Zack Snyder.
Nah.
And then, you know, Tig Notaro has to, like, drag the movie out of the rut by saying, well, you know, I think it's okay because he's Japanese. And Hiroyuki Sanada is, like, also at approximately the same time saying, I am Japanese. It's just so stupid.
Well,
it's dumb.
And it sounds awkward coming out of his mouth to begin with, not because it's, you know, offensive, but because he's playing like, you know, like a mid-2000s Ken Watanabe character. He's playing like Ra's al Ghul, basically. He does not appear to have a personality.
No.
He's just a criminal mastermind, and there's nothing else to him. So when he says easy peasy, Japanese-y, it's like, okay, I can see where this is going. There's no reason for him to have said that except to go into this stupid comedy cul-de-sac where we're gonna, you know, make fun of political correctness for way too long. It's just lame.
Yeah.
It's as jarring as if Ra's al Ghul said, easy peasy Japanese, you know, when he's talking to Bruce Wayne. That's how easy it's going to be for him to, I don't know, decapitate this guy and prove his loyalty to the League of Shadows.
Right.
Actually, Roz, you can't say that. Bruce,
or if during the climax of Batman Begins, they're on the train, like Liam Neeson says, I'm going to make all of the water evaporate using this EMP or whatever the hell it is. Easy peasy, Japanese-y. And fucking Christian Bale goes,
you're not allowed to say that.
The other Roz was allowed to say that, but not you. Fuck off.
Man.
Zack Snyder's Batman Begins.
Yeah, maybe what this betrays is that we're both just pining for, you know, the Nolan years. I don't know.
I guess. I'm pining for Dawn of the Dead 04.
Right.
I'm
about the same time as you know, Batman Begins anyway.
But I'm pining for the days when Zack Snyder could have some fun and not like attempt to have fun, but still come up with a halfway dirge like fucking zombie movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, Jesus Christ, what hath God wrought? What if 300 was never made? Maybe Zack Snyder would be fucking normal still. Who knows?
Who knows?
Or if it had flopped, say.
Right. Yeah, as much as I like the gunplay out on the floor of the casino, it was a case of too little, too late. I mean, that comes shortly after you see Maria get her head owled around, and that sucks complete ass.
It's so stupid.
And, well, it's just like it's such a like, ha, bet you didn't see that coming moment, and it's like. That's true, but it also didn't make me feel anything other than a vague sense of, it's like when your younger brother swears in front of you and is like hoping you'll be impressed, or like, I don't know, the
it's like, go home, Billy.
It just feels juvenile, and I know that's like the easiest accusation to level at Zack Snyder and his works, but
the shoe fits. I mean,
yeah, right.
Christ.
And it felt. This climax has gone on for so long, by the time that they do fight their way onto the floor of the casino, I just thought, okay, you really want to shock me? You really want to throw a curveball at me? Drop the fucking bomb. Do your worst. Just immolate all of these people. And not like they even see it coming. You know, just all of a sudden, just fade to white. Like the end of Watchmen. You know, just fucking fucking incinerate them. Just reduce them to just a dark smear on the wall. Hiroshima them. See if I care. I wouldn't have cared, but I would have respected the cojones.
Right. Well, and the other thing about Maria's death, it's like, okay, if you want to go for the gut punch, like, oh, they think they're about to get away. Here's the elevator. And then, you know, your fucking neck gets broken. Okay, just do that. Don't fucking linger on this cartoony ass, like,
CGI collarbone sticking out.
Well, I was going to get to the collarbone in a minute, but first just the fact that her head is turned around 180 degrees, and then it fucking lingers on that for a while, and she's just, like, kind of blinking, and then just, like, ping! You know, the fucking bone pops out of the shoulder. I mean, it couldn't have been goofier if it tried. And then they cut back to her corpse on the ground one more time.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be like, oh no, she's dead. But it just looks stupid because her head's fucking turned around facing the wrong way.
Yeah, so that's kind of why I was praying for the bomb to fall. That and the fact that it felt like the bomb was way, way, way overdue at this point.
Yes.
I mean, they run out of 20 minutes 20 times.
Well, and there's no reason. Oh, we got an hour and a half left. The deadline is... it's an hour and 20 minutes. Now it's an hour. Now it's 20 minutes. Like, they just, the time skips, like, don't make any sense.
Right.
And it would have been so easy to adjust in such a way that the climax might have worked at least a little better.
Well, yeah, the deadline is whatever you say it is. You can give them an hour to get out of ground zero and have it still be suspenseful because shit can go wrong and there can be complications. You know, they have to go rescue his daughter, for Christ's sake.
And they have fucking 9 minutes,
yeah, right,
to fly from one casino to the other, go get her, get back in the chopper, and get out of the blast zone.
Mm-hmm. And so it's just Looney Tunes. But movies have gotten away with this sort of thing before. One of my favorite examples is near the end of From Beyond, there's a countdown timer where, you know, 20 seconds ticks down and it takes like a minute and a half or something ridiculous. Every time you cut back to it, 1 second has elapsed. It's stupid, but it's sort of knowingly stupid. And because time is being dilated in a way that feels consistent, mm-hmm. it's not as much of an issue. Whereas here, you're right, they have over an hour until all of a sudden they have way less than half an hour. And then they have 20 minutes for 40 minutes.
Yeah, no.
It's like 300, the way that the action slows down and then speeds up. It's just whatever looks coolest. That's always been his MO.
Well, and the thing too, just to crystallize this even more, they see on the TV, it's like one day, 1 hour, 38 minutes, and then, uh-oh, the president moved up the deadline. I'm going to bitch about that newscast in a minute here. So now it's an hour and 38 minutes, and then they go down in the elevator. So they've got about an hour and a half. Dieter has to start from scratch because apparently they messed up his concentration. They ask him how long it's going to be. Half an hour. And we're given no indication that he runs into any additional roadblocks, that there are any complications, that he fucks up somewhere.
Indeed,
anything.
He could not have possibly fucked up because he says if he fucks up one more time, the vault seals permanently. So that has to go off without a hitch.
So he finishes. They're supposed to have like a little over an hour once he opens the vault. And they get the vault door open, and then Dave Bautista's like, all right, we got 20 minutes. What? Where did 40 minutes go? Seriously?
Well, they frittered it away on bullshit, like with all the high fives and the...
They were high-fiving for over half an hour.
On the back. Yeah, right.
Oh, my God. They were just making it rain at nothing for 20 minutes at least. That newscast, like I said.
It's not as bad as the one from the beginning of the movie with Sean Spicer in it.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I barked out, you whore.
Right, like fucking Neil deGrasse Tyson was in Batman v Superman, and he lent like a degree, a modicum of credibility to the speech that he's assigned about the implications of Superman and all that heavy-handed stuff that I don't miss at all from Snyder's Justice League era. But here, well, that's the best you could do, the fucking Spice Man, the disgraced XXX press secretary. Come on.
But also, this one that announces the shortening of the deadline,
mm-hmm.
again, it's like the would-be jokey jokes that just fall flat. I got the impression that we were supposed to be laughing out loud.
This one is enough
dialogue.
Of a dud that I don't even know what you're alluding to.
Okay, they're talking about the reasoning behind moving the deadline, and you know, the president was going to, they wanted to have it on the evening of 4th of July because the president thought it would be, quote, really cool.
Oh, God, yeah.
I was like, barf. Which president are you talking about?
Yeah, that doesn't sound, I mean, Trump is a child, but he's not that flavor of child. Like, that's just not, that phrase isn't really in his vocabulary.
And also, your movie's coming out in May 2021.
Yeah,
you missed the boat.
It's not a Bidenism. I don't know what it is.
It's dumb. It's dumb.
Yeah, it is not, in fact, really cool. Tig is integrated into the movie more seamlessly than I expected. So that was millions of dollars well spent, apparently. In fact, the most, I expected her to just look totally Sky Captain, you know, just completely Sky Captain in the world of tomorrow. And it's not that bad. The most uncanny thing about her, actually, is the CGI smoke always wafting off the tip of her cigarette, which did not fool my eye.
Right.
But other than that, that's fine. I mean, they don't give her anything funny to do or say, which is a waste, but that's true of everyone.
Right.
I keep coming back to the climax just because so much of the movie, I talked about this before the break. I complained about how I wanted more casino shootout kind of spectacle from this movie. I figured going into this movie that there would be 2.5 hours of that kind of stuff, and I would find it sort of fatiguing and not as enjoyable, and oh, why can't Zack Snyder, you know, rein it in a little bit? Instead, it's the opposite. There's way too much downtime. There's way too much fucking talky talk. There's a lot of really pointless stuff of them, like, breaking into the vault, which is not exactly Ocean's 11.
No.
You know, it's like that stuff could have been left on the cutting room floor. A lot of just back and forth banter between the crew. The Rogues Gallery here is just not very interesting. The problem with the premise that they concoct is that most of the movie plays out during a ceasefire between them and the zombies.
Yeah.
That's the situation that they've engineered. There's a shaky truce. And while that is tense in theory, and I kind of like that, however, obviously then what needs to happen during that peacetime is some interesting characters need to say things you're not expecting to one another. And that's just never comes to fruition.
Well, and the other problem with this is that the reason there's no tension that follows from this uneasy truce is because there are no subsequent confrontations between the alphas and the humans until Garrett Dillahunt cuts the queen's head off.
And breaks the truce, right.
Yeah, there's no, like, uneasy, they have to cross paths with an alpha at some point. The only thing is they have to, like, worm their way through some brainless zombies who aren't under the control of the alphas anyway.
Who are you? Who are so stupid that they sleep standing up like cows.
And after a bunch of them are massacred, the alphas are like, shit happens, I guess. If they even notice, which
yeah,
I don't think
right.
they do. Although they would probably have to. They would hear the gunfire.
If not their circus, not their monkeys, clearly.
Right. If you're going to play the card of, like, let's ratchet up the tension and really strain this uneasy truce to the breaking point before it finally does break, there have to be confrontations.
Right.
There has to be near misses. There have to be standoffs before Garrett Dillahunt does his supervillain lackey bullshit.
Yeah, and if you'd had more beats like that, that would have taken a lot of pressure off of our crew of heisters to say quippy, clever, quotable things to one another or engage in these sub-Ocean's 11 antics as they're breaking into the vault. You know, because all of that just bears no fruit.
Yeah.
And then there's, if anything, I don't want to say an overabundance of action because I was hungry for it, as I said, when the shit hits the fan, when all hell breaks loose. The movie goes out with a bang in the most literal sense. That's the stretch of the movie that I kind of liked, and I don't want to oversell it. It's still kind of a huge mess. I mean, characters go missing, like they get just lost in the shuffle. Kate wanders off to do her own thing. I mean, the most egregious example, obviously, is the woman that they rescue who doesn't even get a death. She just gets deleted from the movie when the helicopter crashes.
Yeah, that is fucking ridiculous.
That's a total disaster.
And you know what? The upshot of that in the end is that if Kate hadn't insisted on going, then her dad and Tig Notaro would still have been alive.
Right.
They would have gotten away with whatever little small packet of money Dave Bautista had, he would have given the money to his daughter just like he ended up doing and said, like, go help your friend's kids, give them this money, take care of them, which is what he does as he's dying. The mother still would have died just right. in a nuclear explosion and probably prior to that having been bitten by a zombie, admittedly, instead of in a helicopter crash. But who gives a shit? And again, it's not... It was all for nothing can be a devastating ending, obviously.
Sure. So let's see the body. Let's see something. Let's have some kind of payoff there. I know this is the point you're building to. I'm getting ahead of myself. But it wasn't a Saving Private Ryan, was it all worth it thing. And it also isn't a nihilistic, it definitely was not all worth it. It's just a total
mishmash.
Yeah.
It's not a... spoilers ahead, incidentally. It is not The Mist.
Right. Where we've spoiled The Mist before.
That's true, we have. Where Thomas Jane... doesn't he have to, like, shoot his girlfriend or his kid or something?
Yeah, he mercy kills everyone but himself, and then I think is out of bullets, and then, yeah.
And then immediately The Mist clears and the military shows up, mm-hmm. like 15 seconds later. And that's Jesus Christ, why didn't you wait?
You and you want to talk about classic bummer endings. Heist movies famously end in that manner all the time. I mean, my favorite is probably the Kubrick film, The Killing.
The Rafifi.
Yeah, right. Like, they don't get away with it. And no one gets the money. Fargo, no one gets the money. Peninsula, no one gets the money. It's like, that's how these movies end. And that's how this one ends... mostly, but like during the mayhem, I lost track of where the fucking money was, and not in a cool, like, nihilistic The Killing kind of way. It wasn't like fucking Treasure of the Sierra Madre. I just didn't know who had it. I didn't know how much they had. Dave Bautista pulls a little parcel out of his vest at the end of the movie, and that's all they managed to get out with. At that point, I had kind of just stopped keeping tabs on people, places, and things.
Is this movie supposed to be about money? at that point, you don't fucking remember.
Right.
All you remember is the Phantom of the Paradise zombie.
Yeah, and his bulletproof phantom mask.
God. Well, do you want to do some recommendations now?
Yeah, this week I'm going to recommend Phantom of the Paradise. Brian De Palma's 1974 classic came out before Rocky Horror, as he always stresses every time the subject comes up, which is pretty funny. That's a good movie, very fine picture. Definitely check that one out. I also watch The Killing if you haven't seen The Killing.
Rafifi, as long as we're going with classic heist movies. Fargo.
Play Fallout New Vegas if you haven't.
It's good stuff. I guess I'm just going to come right out and recommend 28 Days Later and Snyder's Dawn of the Dead.
Definitely a good double feature.
Because those are both movies that are trying to do a lot of what this movie is trying to do. One of them, obviously, from the same director back when he was better at doing what he's trying to do now. Yeah, I mean, we talked about them at some length in the body of this episode. But 28 Days Later really revolutionized the subgenre. Even though your mileage may vary on whether or not they're actually zombies. But, beyond genre nerd disputes, they're functionally zombies. So there you go. They count. And, yeah, like Matt said, it goes from, well, one of two things. Either you get bitten, or if it's the Romero style and you just fucking die in this new world, you come back as a zombie no matter how you die. Now it's a pathogen thing. If you get the slightest bodily fluid on you in the wrong place, if zombie blood gets into your mucous membranes, you're fucked. That ratchets up the intensity like a motherfucker.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, Dawn of the Dead 04 is just good fun. Ving Rhames is a cop, and he has a shotgun. I mean, that alone is enough to make me watch for 100 minutes.
Yeah, I think I like the ensemble cast in that movie better than I do this time around.
The
interplay is on another level.
Yeah, and the jokes actually play in that movie. They're not all gold, but there's legitimately funny dialogue in that movie, and it fits into the flow of the movie as opposed to bringing the fucking movie to a grinding halt.
Yeah, and Snyder's needle drops aren't as cringe-inducing, or weren't then, as they are today.
How did we fucking missed this? The coda with Van Der Rohe getting out of the rubble and then going home in his car.
Zombie. But like an orchestral remix, kind of. There were like strings under it, underpinning it, that weren't in the original track.
In any case, I'm pretty sure we've dunked on this in the course of the podcast. The Andrew Dominik film, Killing Them Softly, from 2012, Matt and I have since then just repeatedly given it shit.
2012 was the year, wasn't it? Hothead.
I guess.
All of our fucking movie opinions just crystallized.
We haven't come up with anything new since then. But there's a scene where they're shooting up heroin. Some grungy, scummy characters are shooting up heroin, and the Velvet Underground song Heroin plays.
Yeah.
How do you have the fucking balls to play zombie in a zombie movie and not for laughs?
Right. It'd be like playing Fortunate Son in a Vietnam movie in 2021. It can only elicit laughs at this point.
But even that isn't even as bad, because the only reason it's goofy is because it's tropey.
It'd be like if Fortunate Song was called Vietnam.
Right.
You know, or heroin or zombie.
Exactly.
It's just, yeah, okay. Put the best minds of our generation to work on that one. Really hunting for deep cuts through the archives. Yeah, it's stupid. I am actually going to recommend Cemetery Man, I guess.
Sure.
Just because the zombies are weird. They're way out of left field, for one thing, in kind of a Return of the Living Dead sort of way. They play fast and loose with the rules in a way that I like. And that movie also does emotional whiplash in a way that feels purposeful and impactful and not just benumbing. You know, I mean, that movie teeters and pendulums back and forth between slapstick and tragedy. And the net feeling is not like that grim or dispiriting. It is a relatively high-spirited movie, but there is kind of a melancholia in it too. And the movie kind of deftly oscillates between those two modes in a way Zack Snyder should be so lucky, at least these days.
Yeah. With that, I think we're going to catch the last chopper out of Vegas here. So
yeah,
until next time. I'm Jib Smith.
Yeah, we got about 9 minutes to go before the fucking mushroom cloud takes off. I'm what's left of Matt Gerandese.
We're the Shock Doctors. We'll see you next time. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Army of the Dead official trailer Netflix, uploaded by Netflix. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, June 20th, and we will be discussing A Quiet Place Part 2, a long-delayed sequel to John Krasinski's 2018 Nailbiter. See you then.